Okay. Yesterday we introduced the concept of Mashiach, the coming of the Messiah, being the 12th principle in the Rambam's list of 13 principles, where every day we anticipate the arrival of Mashiach. We talked in general terms yesterday, but what we did not address is really the more fundamental question of why is this such an important part? Why is this such an important principle that is the core of being a Jew? And we touched a little bit on it, but it really needs a further elaboration. I think that if we look at a general idea, we can agree on one thing. History, from a Jewish perspective, history is not a random series of events. Things don't just happen. There is a planned destiny with a goal in mind. We talked about this in the very beginning when we talked about why did God create the world and the universe in the first place. There clearly is a plan. This wasn't just haphazard. God has a plan, a design for this world to accomplish. He gave us free will. He gave us the opportunity to be partners with God, to be a partner with him in order to bring the world to its perfection. Again, we said it yesterday, people quote it as tikkun olam. We're here to perfect the world. What exactly that entails? Well, that's part of a much larger discussion. But the mere fact that there is an idea that we're here to accomplish and to make the world better means there's a goal. So as history unfolds, there is definitely a planned destiny leading towards a goal. Civilizations have undergone and continue to experience paradigm shifts, requiring the world to adapt to new realities. We are living that reality right now. It will go down in the history books, what we are experiencing right now. My girls and I, we were talking at the Shabbos table over Yom Tov, and they giggled a little bit, and I said, "What's so funny?" And they said, "We're going to be part of history." I said, "You're always a part of history. This is just very pronounced." But that is the truth. Throughout time, we have gone through different civilizations, from an agricultural society to an industrialized one, perhaps to an informational, and now even a technological world. History is moving, and the world shifts and adapts. Jewish history is no different. The only factor that might be different is what the changes are occurring within. The changes are much more in the spiritual environment that impacts our free-willed choices and our ability to achieve perfection. In the beginning, there was Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. There was a reality. That was what we'll call, for all intents and purposes, utopia. There was a garden. There was everything that they needed was in front of them. They had an opportunity to choose good or evil, which we'll talk about in a moment. But they chose one path, and that now caused a paradigm shift in the environment of how we live our lives. We no longer have a Garden of Eden existence. As my grandmother would always say, now it's a machaleben. You got to work for a living. You got to go out and you have to accomplish. Well, that was great. I mean, not great, but we did it. But we moved again when we got to a point of where we got a Torah. And again, we travel and we get to the land of Israel and we build the first temple. When we had the first temple, the environment of spirituality and godliness in the world was much more pronounced. Yet only 410 years later, it's destroyed. And we go into exile. And again, there's a paradigm shift of what kind of environment do we find ourselves spiritually. The same with the second temple. And ever since the destruction of the second temple, we are continually going from place to place, from country to country, persecution to persecution through the exiles. This is part of a larger plan, not haphazard and not random. But to really appreciate, we need to look back in order to go forward to understand where Mashiach fits into this. Let's start at the beginning again. The purpose of man in this world, if you need it at any point in this series of classes and lectures. By the time we're done, you should be able to answer this. What is the purpose of man in this world? You should answer so that man can earn a connection with God in an environment that allows for both good and evil. And you have your constant battle to use and exercise your free will to choose good. That's the summary of why there is a world, of why we are here to make that choice. There's a constant battle, that struggle within us of what we will call body versus soul. It's what the body wants versus what the soul needs. But it's important to remember this point. Judaism does not subscribe to the notion or belief that man is saved by anyone. We redeem ourselves by the choices we make. We talked about this when we discussed the concept of free will. However, what Mashiach's era, the period of the Messiah, is what it ushers in is a universal acknowledgement of God, and God's presence is clearly apparent. You see, we live in a world now where God's presence is hidden. It's concealed. I may have shared with you the fact that we call the world Olam. We call this world Olam Hazeh. The word Olam is related to the Hebrew word He'elam, which means concealment. God is hidden in our world. God is not abundantly clear. If you look, you see it. But walking down the street, unless you have your eyes open and your mind and heart conditioned to be open to see it, you can walk right past it and never realize there is a God in this world. God is hidden. And our job purposely is that once it's hidden, we need to dig a little deeper and to find God. That is the challenge of free will. That is the challenge we face of where it is concealed. However, once Mashiach arrives, it ushers in an era of where it's so blatantly obvious. If any of us had been around at the time of the splitting of the seas or the plagues, we would not have had a question. It would have been so clear. The Sinai experience, God speaking to an entire nation, it would have been so abundantly clear. That's the era of Mashiach. And you'll ask me, I think, a very simple question. That means, for all intents and purposes, the free will exercise is no longer in effect. Because, again, the free will exercise has to have two viable options, good and evil. The same with Pavlov's experiments. If you consistently, over and over and over, and condition the dog, condition the mouse, it will choose it. So that's not a free will choice. There needs to be freedom of choice. But if I'm telling you, if the rabbi here is saying that in the time of Mashiach, it's going to be so blatantly clear, God will be acknowledged, then what's the point? There's no longer a struggle between good and evil. No more ability to earn merit or demerit. Then what's the point? No longer is there an opportunity to earn, but as we said the other day, it's too early to start receiving reward. Reward is not until what we call the world to come. So what exactly is the point of the Messianic era? Do you understand the question? We're caught between the rock and the hard place here. If the whole point of our struggle of 6,000 years, again, using just that as an example, if our struggles currently of 5,780 years is specifically to earn, because I have two choices between good and evil, and I earn it by doing the right thing, I understand. I'm accruing tokens. I have two viable options, and I try to consistently choose one that's going to earn positive tokens. But if in the time of Mashiach, it's no longer going to be a challenge. It's a no-brainer. So you're not going to earn tokens. Then what's the point? Oh, to receive reward for all the good choices? You're not ready to cash in your chips yet. That's not until the world to come. So what exactly is this Messianic era and what is the point? So we got to go back to the beginning, folks, back to the Garden of Eden. Because that's where it all started. What I'm going to share with you is based very much on what's called the Derech Hashem. It's a book known as The Way of God, written by the Ramchal, Rav Moshe Chaim Luzzatto. I recommend it highly. It's not a book you pick up at 11:30 in bed with a drink in one hand and the book in the other. It doesn't work that way. It is one of the most core and basic books on Jewish philosophy. The Ramchal tells us that we know that when God created Adam and Eve, when they were first created, they were comprised of two equal but opposite parts. God formed man out of physical earth, but also infused within him a soul. So there's body and soul. There's physicality and spirituality. But when God created the first man, and this is all pre-sin, this is an important idea. Before Adam and Eve ate from that tree, there was a balance between these two entities, two opposite entities of body and soul. The example that many give is the idea of a horse and rider. Who's in charge? The rider. The rider is the one who gives direction. But there's almost no way for the rider to get to his or her destination without the horse. It's too far down the road. Man does not have the ability by itself to just magically get there. You need a vehicle. You need something that's going to allow you to traverse the terrain. And therefore, the soul is the rider, supposed to be giving direction, perfectly balanced with the vehicle that will allow him to do it. That's the body. God created this creature, Adam, Eve, and put them in a situation where it was a good balance, where it was understood Adam knew that his main entity was his soul. He perceived the Garden of Eden and everything around him was an ability to recognize and acknowledge God. But there's an upside and a downside to this. The upside is that it didn't take much effort to acquire even his physical sustenance. He just needed to provide any energy and power to his spiritual side. His physical needs would be taken care of. The Medrash actually describes that the angels provided all of his needs. The way they describe it, it'd be like my utopia of where they had roasted meat and poured wine. Bring it on. I'm ready to go back to that existence. All of their physical needs were taken care of. But there's a downside. Downside being is that it was a sense of total dependency on God. His existence was not in his control. Yes, he had choice, but it was almost a no-brainer. It was no choice. He needed to make a choice. Keep with the dependency on God, or to become an independent source in his mind and allow the physicality to determine his future. This is a very deep concept, and I'm probably not doing it justice. But understand that the decision Adam and Eve made was not just because they were hungry for a fruit. This was cosmic in nature, that they had to choose, or they chose, what was primary. Was it going to remain the spiritual rider, the soul, and the body was going to be used properly as a vehicle to accomplish? Or were they going to upset that balance and switch it? Are you now going to give primacy to the physical, thereby rejecting God, which is in effect what it was, because God said, don't eat from that tree? So they chose. Well, let's put it this way. Let's talk about the positive. Had they chosen good, which meant simply, don't eat from that tree for a period of time. And if you've ever studied the Talmud tells us that Adam was created on the sixth day of creation, midday or so. He only had a couple of hours till it was Shabbos. At that point, he would have ushered in what we call Shabbos. He would have ushered in a type of balanced world, harmony. But before he did that, he ate from it. Had he chosen to follow God's command not to eat from that tree, the soul would have had dominance over his body and ultimately attain an immediate sense of perfection. This was the one test. What is Adam and Eve? What are they going to do? Are they going to stick with the plan, or are they going to try and change the balance? there would have been a complete understanding of the proper roles of spirituality, the rider, the soul, and physicality, the horse, the body. When they ate from that tree, it was a rejection of God. It was a rejection of their wanting to be dependent on God. And ultimately, it changed the view of physicality in their minds as no longer just a means to an end, but an end unto itself. That changed everything. Does that mean our test is any different? The answer is no, but now it is much harder to attain that goal and to reach the perfection, because now we have so many more obstacles in our way. Whereas Adam and Eve only had to choose at that moment to follow the command or not, once they changed the equation, it's as if everybody put on a pair of glasses that distorted our view, that distorted our vision of what the world is, where God is, what our role in all of this is. We're wearing lenses on our eyes. I don't mean physically. We're wearing lenses on our eyes that are not helping our vision, but in fact are distorting it. And the challenge now is to, while wearing those distorted glasses, to find God anyway. This is the challenge because of that event. Now let's fast forward to the end of the story. The end of the story is, again, there was a plan. There was a design and a goal. The goal over history was to return now back to that Garden of Eden pre-sin state of spiritual sensitivity. That's where we need to go. We need to rise above that concealment. We need to rise and understand that quote unquote nature, what we call Mother Nature, is just a hidden concealment of God. Some love to point out that the Hebrew word for nature, Hateva, Hateva has the same numerical value as God's name, Elohim. Yeah, because ultimately, God is nature. Nature is a tool in God's tool belt. But we need to see that. We need to somehow rise above that concealment of nature and attribute the true power, the true source, not to the physicality, but to the spirituality. To realize that the real nature of our existence is spirituality and God's presence on earth. Is it achievable? Yeah. Is it hard? Oh, yes. It's extremely difficult. 5,780 years of our history have proven it. How many of us have fallen off the wagon by not being able to see it? How difficult it is, even for those of us who truly believe it, who even can in some way see it, it's still a struggle every single day. The achievement of that awareness that man and everything in this universe has God at the center of his consciousness, that's the goal. Let me put it very simply. The clarity of man's vision post-Mashiach is the same level of clarity of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden pre-sin. That's where we need to go with it. We are in the midst of the struggle, but the end result is to get back to that point of the Garden of Eden existence. Therefore, we do that. We bring the world and the entire purpose of creation to completion. Therefore, if you don't have the concept that there is an end goal, where there's a goal of reaching that same balance between recognizing what the role of physicality is and the role of spirituality is, if you don't know that that's the ultimate goal that we want to get to, then what's the point? What are we going through? I feel like we're like the weasel on the wheel. But if you know there's a goal, you know there's an end point that we want to attain, we want to reach it, then it puts it all in perspective. The period of the Messianic era is an integral part of this world, bringing it to completion. Not necessarily the place where there's reward, no. This is the completion of our world, from the time of Adam and Eve's challenge and thereby failure to the point of where ultimately we will pass and succeed the test. As we said yesterday, by hook or by crook. We can choose to do it on our own, or God will bring it. But understand, Mashiach's era, that whole concept of Mashiach coming and what it will usher in, a sense of universal acknowledgement of God, is not the next worldly concept. It's this worldly. It's putting the perspective of physicality and spirituality back in its right place. Is it a bridge to the next phase of the world to come and the resurrection? Yes, that's principle 13, which we will start tomorrow, God willing. But understand that that's what the role of Mashiach is. Let me take an extra few minutes before I take questions, because if I've confused you, let me go further then. It's great. If you look in much of Judaic literature, it always tries to find patterns. It tries to find historical events that are related in the sense of, again, there's a design, there's a purpose. It's not just haphazard. In much of Judaic literature, it describes the Jewish people's journeys into four exiles, four diasporas that we have gone through. It starts officially. Egypt doesn't count because it's really the root, although it all comes from there. But that is what forged us as a nation. Once we were a nation, we went through four periods of exile. The first being after the destruction of the first temple with Babylonia. The second being soon thereafter under the Persian rule. That's the story of Purim. We went back into Israel, built the second temple. And even while the second temple was built, we became exiled in the sense of being under the rule of Greece. That's the Hanukkah story. And then ultimately, we have the one that we're exiled in currently, which is the destruction of the second temple by Rome. Those are the four general exiles that are referred to. Dalit Goliot is what it's called. We can do an entire series just on all of these. But suffice it to say, as it pertains to our class tonight, each one of them really had a focus that each of those nations tried to impress and believe that that is what the world should understand. And the fact that we had the opposite approach. We're the ones, as the Jewish people, that clung to a belief contrary to theirs, is what proves this idea. Allow me to explain. Babel, Babylonia, was all about the power of conquest, the power that man can use their strength to accomplish and to conquer. That's what Babel was all about. It was conquering the world. Persia was much more about displaying wealth, about man's possessions. If you recall in the Purim story, Ahasuerus made a party. Wish I was at that party? No, but a 180-day party. Yeah, that's a party. It was all about displaying all of the wealth that they had. Greece was all about culture, was all about enlightenment, a focus on the body. And Rome was much better than that. Rome was all about science. Rome was all about technology. At each one of these stages, we were thrown a curveball. And that is, we were tested. Are we going to cling to our belief that man is essentially a spiritual being in connection with God, trying to perhaps rectify Adam and Eve's sin? Or are we going to fall prey to yet another ism where it's not God at the center, but man is at the center? These are the representatives of four different philosophies. Have we kicked all of them down yet? No. We're three down, one to go. I could spend another half an hour talking about the one that we're in now about technology. I gave a class, it was an hour, maybe I can get it down to 20 minutes, but let me give you a punchline. Technology, we are so dependent on it today, and it's not as a bad thing. Our lives in many ways have become drastically shaped and affected by technology. The survival, because of all of the advancements of medicine, is phenomenal. The fact that we can work from home, We're no longer in the nomadic tribes. We're no longer even in the agricultural world or even the industrial world. You know, it's fascinating. Time is now, I mean, technology even has an effect on time. How many of us go crazy if you have to wait in a waiting room for Zoom for more than a minute? We're going out of our mind. Or we lose our Wi-Fi connection. Oh, chas v'shalom, heaven forbid. Ay, 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 ay. You know, it's like an eternal wait until that blue circle stops spinning. How long did it take? 30 seconds? Time it next time. You'll be shocked how short it is. But it's an interminable time for us. Technology is a tool in our hands. And technology can be used positively or negatively. Again, I won't go through all of it, but I think it's a pretty simple idea. But what is so significant about it? I'll tell you why. Today, this class is proof that technology is not only because of man's achievements, but it can be used to understand God. I always wondered growing up, and I'm not even that old. Some of you must have been wondering this longer than me. How the heck are we all going to know when Mashiach comes? How's that going to happen? He's going to show up somewhere. Remember, he's a man, flesh and blood. He's not some angel that can be in 30 places at one time. He's a flesh and blood man. He's going to come somewhere and he's going to announce he's Mashiach. Great. I don't live in that town. How am I going to know about it? You know what? We have Twitter. We got Facebook. We got Instagram. We got Zoom. We got news 24-hour-a-day cycles. If it happens anywhere, we're all going to know about it instantaneously. I don't mean it in a joking way. I'm dead serious. Technology is a tool that can and should be utilized, not for greatness of man. Of course, it's an achievement of man. But don't forget, it's a tool like everything else in the physical world. What's primary and what's secondary? Use the physical world. Again, Judaism does not want us to deny it, but use it properly. Recognize that it's a tool. It's a means to an end, not an end unto itself. It is, in fact, I can share with you, the Zohar actually predicted this explosion of technology thousands of years ago. If you're interested, email me. I'll send you a couple of sources for you to look at. But it's not shocking, because the Zohar, which is one of the great books of mysticism, understands that all of this is in order to reach the goal. If we have to get to this endpoint of where there's a universal acknowledgement of God, well, how are we going to unify everybody? 100 years ago, we were scattered everywhere. One country, if you knew what was going on there, you had no idea. No idea. Maybe you caught a news report of something that happened last week. Just 100 years ago. We have to remember this. This is really what Mashiach is all about. The idea, very simply, and that is that the period of Mashiach is an integral part of explaining the purpose of creation and what the goal is, and our intent on going back to that way, of going back to that Garden of Eden existence, of where there was a perfectly understood balance between the sensitivity that spirituality is A1 and that physicality is B1. That's what it's there for. What you do after Mashiach, how do we collect our chips, how does it work? Stay tuned for Principle 13, because that's where it's going. But understand that that's the role that Mashiach plays here. Questions? Robin?
So I think you would ask originally, you know, why is it that there's, we get there and there's like sort of no free will? Are you there in the messianic era? So I'm still not, I understand the whole thing about how we're getting back to that point, like you said at the end, of the spirituality. But then we get to that point and it's obvious to everybody, then I guess you're saying there isn't free will, but we have worked to that point. Is that what you're saying?
we have to go through a period of where we recreate that balance.
Right, but once we get to the Messianic era, you're saying there's not going to be free will, because then we'll see everything.
It won't be free will. I'm afraid to say there's no choice, but it's certainly not going to be 50-50. It might be 90-10. It might be 95-5. I don't know an exact percentage, but the role of free will, of choosing between good and evil so that you can earn more, is no longer applicable. The goal is to recreate that existence. Why? There's one more step, principle 13. We're going to get there. But you first, before we can get to that world to come of to collecting our chips, we have to fix the mistake. We have to recreate that environment of perfect balance, body and soul. That's the era of Mashiach.
Got it. Thank you.
Rabbi.
Yes, doctor.
When someone sends us a Twitter or a Facebook page announcement that, behold, I'm the Mashiach and I can prove it to you, what is to be our response? How are we to know when that individual appears in our world?
So if you recall, yesterday we said that one of the criteria is that he has to be a prophet. Well, we already have criteria on record. The Torah tells us how you test a prophet. We have a whole slew of requirements and prerequisites, I don't know, whatever the word is, that he has to fulfill. It's not going to be just he puts a Twitter post somewhere and says, hi, I'm the Mashiach. He's going to have to show it in a way that we described yesterday with his character, his Torah knowledge, his military strategy, his prophecies. There's a whole long list of things. That's the testing. That's the prof. That's the way we'll know. But it will be so abundantly clear.
It will be clear to a Shiite Muslim who believes that the world must can be taken by an Islamic prophet, or the Christians who believe that's the second coming of JC. How are they going to recognize this Jewish prophet?
Doc, stick around. I can't describe for you how they're going to know. All I know is that the Mashiach will be so universally recognized as a leader, bringing this world to an understanding of Hashem Echad Ushemo Echad. How he's going to do it, I'm not privy to that. That's way above my pay grade. But yeah. The answer is yes. Everyone will, from the Shiite Muslim to the Christian to everybody in between, the Buddhist, everybody will come to that recognition. You ask me, how is that possible? I can't fathom it. I'm in the same camp as you.
Okay. Thank you.
We good? All right. So here's the plan. The plan, God willing, is tomorrow night we will start, we'll see how far we get, but principle 13. I want to plant a bug in your ear. I don't know about you guys, but I am happy to continue after we finish all 13 principles. Let me just turn off the recording here.